Good morning. I'm Shelley Ryan, in for Larry Mueller for this edition of Garden Talk. Today, we're talking with Neil DeBole of Prairie Nursery in Westfield, Wisconsin, and we're going to talk about prairie plants and how to establish a prairie in your own backyard. Our guest will be happy to answer your questions and respond to your experiences at 1-800-642-1234, and that's toll-free from anywhere you are listening, 1-800-642-1234. If you're in Madison, please use 263-1890-1890, or send your question via email to talk@wpr.org. Please include your name and the community you're calling from or emailing from as well. As I said, we're with Neil DeBole, and Neil and I go way back. I am also the host and the producer of The Wisconsin Gardener on Wisconsin Public Television. Our next new program on television will be coming up on May 15th. So in the meantime, though, we can be talking spring. And Neil, welcome.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Yeah, Neil and I have done this before, and we usually get into trouble, so this should be a fun couple hours. You are the prairie ecologist and landscape designer and president of Prairie Nursery. And I have to say that the very first thing I put into my backyard when we moved out to my home in Blue Mounds was a prairie.
Excellent.
You know, so you taught me right, Neil.
Good choice.
And the question I'm hearing this year, and I'm going to let you deal with it because I'm not sure what the answer is. One of the first snows we had, especially in southern Wisconsin, was that very thick, heavy, heavy layer of ice. A lot of people are wondering what we're going to find when the snow melts.
It's a good question. It's going to be Pandora's box out there. But one thing is, because we had that early snow, it insulated the ground. So the frost in a lot of areas did not go very deep. And in some cases, it's very shallow. And that allows for the growth of fungi and other creatures at the surface that may be possibly affecting plants. It may just be a big messy pile, but you might be seeing turf problems with destruction of the leaves and the surface area. But the ice in some areas may have done some smothering damage, may have cut off oxygenation to the plants. But you know, the soil freezes anyway, so you don't have a lot of oxygen movement during the winter. But that can cause problems, and you know, the people that really worry about that are farmers with their alfalfa fields, because if you get ice over that can be really destructive.
Do you think prairie plants are going to be any more susceptible? Or,
you know, in my experience of working with these plants for almost 30 years, they're amazingly tough, and you know, they grew up here, so we'll see. But I don't expect a lot of issues with that. The biggest problem we see are when you have dry soil conditions with an open winter where the frost can go down 6, 7, 8 feet deep,
Good
and there's
point.
Not a lot of moisture in the ground, and that's when plants really get damaged. So the snow cover is probably going to work to our advantage.
That's true. We've had many droughty winters, so,
yes.
So at least we won't have that problem this year.
No, we're definitely not having that problem. And the snow melt is perfect because it's going slowly.
I know it. It's not in my basement yet. I'm very happy. Well, let's talk. Now, here you're speaking to the converted because I've been through this, but let's talk for the listeners about, if you want a prairie, how do you get that started?
Well, it depends on whether you want to do a prairie garden using transplants or whether you want to create a larger prairie meadow, usually using seeds. But the most important thing, no matter which route you go, is soil preparation. This is the number one factor and usually the commonly overlooked factor where, oh my God, where'd all these weeds come from after you plant it? So you have to be very, very sensitive to what's growing there. Know what you're up against. For instance, if you have a lawn, that's relatively easy to convert because you can smother that. And usually if it's a lawn without any weeds, in a couple of months, by smothering it with like newspaper and leaves or compost, or you can use black plastic, old carpet, cardboard, and you hold it on the soil with like fence posts or rocks or whatever, just so it doesn't blow away. That usually takes about 2, maybe 3 months to kill everything. And then you can plant your plants right into that, or you can scatter your seed in the fall onto the killed soil, and the seed will work its way down into the ground naturally. However, if you have an abandoned agricultural field that's just grown up to weeds for the last 5, 10, 15 years, now you have issues with perennial weeds like quackgrass, maybe some Canada thistle. Usually you see Canada goldenrod. These are problem plants because they have rhizomes, and they will creep all around, and they're much more difficult to kill because those rhizomes are resistant to tillage. You just break them up. You don't necessarily kill them. If you're using herbicides, sometimes it only kills part of the rhizome so they can come back. So usually if you have a situation like that, you're looking at a full year of site preparation, sometimes even 2 years.
To get rid of all that stuff.
And then you have the weed seeds that are harbored
still going
in the soil.
To be, yep.
Yeah, so we will spend the first year usually killing the perennial plants, and in the second year we'll work trying to eliminate or at least reduce the density of weed seeds in the surface soil.
So patience is a virtue, and unfortunately it's not one of mine. But we have actually one of our first callers has a similar question, so let's see if we can help him out. This is from Wausau. Art, good morning. Go ahead, please.
Thank you for taking my call. You already answered part of my question. I wanted to replace my lawn with some prairie plants and spend as little time mowing as possible. So I understand I could cover the grass and kill it, but then do you have to reseed the prairie every year?
No, this is the beauty of prairie. This is a native ecosystem composed almost exclusively of perennials. There are a few biennials, occasionally an annual here and there. But once you put down the seed of a good prairie mix that contains a nice blend of flowers and grasses, once it's in, you should never have to replant that for your lifetime, or if it's properly maintained, really pretty much forever.
And where could I get more information about that? I actually live in Eau Claire, but I'm in Wausau today.
Oh, you can order our catalog or go to our website. You can call us at 1-800-476-9453. That's 1-800-GROW-WILD, G-R-O-W-I-L-D. Or you can go to our website, and that's prairienursery.com. And there's a lot of information on that about site preparation, different types of blends of seed mixes, et cetera, et cetera.
All right, thank you.
You're welcome. Okay, our next caller is from Viroqua, and this is Bob. Bob, go ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Good morning.
The question that I have is relative to milkweed plants. I like monarch butterflies around, and milkweed plants attract them. Last fall, what I did was, because there aren't very many around, I saved seeds from the seed pod, and I have them in the house here. How do I plant those?
You're lucky because you picked a very simple, easy plant to grow. I'm assuming this is the common milkweed, Bob. Would you know?
I think it is, yeah.
Okay. That's the most commonly found species here. We have a number of different milkweeds, all of which are good for monarchs. But the common milkweed, it's called, in this case, milkweed for a reason. It does tend to be a little bit weedy, but it is great for monarchs. That seed does not require any special treatment. You can put that in the ground as soon as the soil warms up, probably around mid-May, and you should start to see germination within, assuming you get moisture or you water it, you should see germination within a couple of weeks.
Okay, so it's easy to grow.
It's really easy to grow. And it is rhizomatous. It does creep by runners. So beware, it is going to spread typically, so be careful.
So if I put it in a garden sort of setup where I want it somewhat contained.
Where you can control it?
Right. Mm-hmm. Do I need to bury something so far down into the ground at the perimeter of the garden to prevent
it? If you want to keep it in a specified area, yes, you would want to either put down some kind of a metal barrier or a plastic barrier about six inches, eight inches deep. Yeah, the rhizomes typically stay in the top 4 to 5 inches. And if you put them in without that, then they're going to spread. Usually, they can creep 12 to 24 inches a year.
Okay. Does the original plant come back year after year then?
Yes, it's a perennial. The average lifespan of a common milkweed is usually 10 to 20 years.
Oh, okay.
It will eventually start to fade out, especially in competition from other grasses, plants, et cetera. But it's a pretty long-lived perennial.
Good deal.
Good luck.
Thank you.
You bet.
Thanks, Bob. Question tied in with that. Somebody told me once that milkweed, the wild native, the common milkweed, if you find that growing in a patch in your yard, it's a sign of healthy soil and a healthy environment. Have you heard that?
I've not heard that. It's a very adaptable plant. It will grow in heavy clay. It will grow in dry sand. And it will grow in fairly moderately acid soil to pretty alkaline soil. So being such a broad-ranging plant, maybe it's a measurement of different nutrients. I'm not aware of that. But one thing I should point out, the common milkweed really does not make the best garden plant because it does spread by rhizomes. There are many, many other milkweeds, such as the Sullivan's milkweed, Asclepias sullivantii, which does creep by runners, but at a very reduced pace. And it's just as good as the common milkweed at attracting monarchs. It looks very similar. It has that nice fragrance that the common milkweed does, kind of a perfumey fragrance. And then there's butterfly weed, which grows typically on well-drained soils, although we do have a strain that grows on clay.
Do you?
Yes.
I'll be in touch.
Butterfly weed for clay. And that plant only gets about 2 feet tall. It doesn't get as tall as the common milkweed or the Sullivan's milkweeds, which gets about 4 to 5 feet. So if you have a smaller garden, the butterfly weed is a good choice. If you have a loose, pretty well-drained soil or a well-drained clay, you can use a butterfly weed for clay and get very good results and attract monarchs with that as well.
Well, and aren't there some liatris as well that are good for butterflies?
Oh, you know, that's a good question. If you're looking at butterflies, you need to look at the whole life cycle. Okay, the milkweeds are great because they provide food for the larva.
Right.
For the caterpillar.
For the caterpillars.
That's so important.
So if you see a caterpillar on the underside of a milkweed plant, don't kill it. It's probably the one you want to keep.
Yes, and you'll see it has green, black, and white stripes. Okay, and it's, you know, it's, of course, it's a beautiful, beautiful butterfly, not only in the butterfly stage, but the chrysalis is a work of art.
Absolutely gorgeous. They look like jewelry.
They do, don't they? It looks like you should make earrings out of them. And, in fact, I have seen earrings made that look to, are made
hopefully
to look like
they let them hatch first, but
yes, right.
We have a, they're starting to be kind of a threatened creature.
Their populations fluctuate with weather conditions, habitat loss, et cetera. Yeah. But the liatris, the genus liatris, which are the blazing stars, are fantastic for as a nectar plant. For monarch butterflies, but the absolute best is the meadow blazing star.
Yes, that was the one. Okay.
It's an incredible Liatris ligula stylus, and they cannot resist it. If you want monarchs, plant the meadow blazing star, and you will be amazed. They will come.
I've seen them in the summer. It almost looked like the plant itself was alive and moving down the road.
I mean,
it was just smothered with butterflies. It's
exactly.
Gorgeous.
They can't resist it.
Well, let's take, let's see, this is Marv, I think it is, from Belleville. Marv, go ahead, please.
Is that Mary from Belleville?
Oh, Mary, I'm sorry. It looks like a V. Maybe I need better glasses here. Yeah, I'm sorry, Mary.
last June, we put in a selection of 6 different prairie grasses from Prairie Nursery in an area which had nothing growing in it. A shed had been taken down. It was bare earth. We got a nice stand, and I battled mallow all summer long, tried to get cut it off at the grass or at the soil level so it wouldn't continue. Now I'm worried about what's going to come up this spring in the way of weeds. Our lawnmower will not go any higher than 4 inches. Is that going to be too low for mowing, and when should we mow?
Okay, if you look at your second year of a prairie, and maybe we should spend just a couple minutes on prairie maintenance after you put the seed down.
Uh-huh.
The first year, typically you'll keep it mowed at about 6, maybe 8 inches.
Uh-huh.
Okay, or you can go in, if you know what's there, you can very carefully, selectively remove weeds, but that's very dangerous. You don't want to pull weeds because oftentimes you'll pull up the prairie seedlings with the weeds, and then you'll have nothing. So we generally do not recommend pulling weeds in the first growing season. Then the second year, you typically will see biennial weeds like Queen Anne's Lace, sweet clover, burdock. These are the bad guys, and you want to keep them from coming back from seed. So you need to mow them at 12 inches. The best thing to use is a weed whacker or a handheld scythe.
Okay. Thank you for that call. We will come back and we can talk some more about that in just a few minutes. We are talking with Neil DeBole of Prairie Nursery in Westfield, Wisconsin. We invite you to join in with your own questions. Call 1-800-642-1234 or 263-1890, 1-890 if you're in Madison. I'm Shelley Ryan sitting in for Larry Mueller, and this is Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Welcome back to Garden Talk on this Friday morning with Neil DeBole. We're taking questions and calls. Neil, was there anything else you wanted to add to that last question, or did we cover it pretty well?
One thing is when you're managing your prairie the second year to control primarily biennial weeds, if it's a larger area, a weed whacker or a handheld scythe is not going to do the job. And maybe the caller has a larger area. It didn't sound like it was big, but I don't know.
No, yeah.
On a larger area, that's where you need something like a tractor-mounted mower, or a sickle bar, which runs off of the tractor off to the side. And the best type of mower is a flail-type mower, which chops up the material.
Okay.
As opposed to a rotary mower, because what happens with a rotary mower a lot of times is that the chopped-up material will kind of glom onto one side of the mower housing, and then you'll have these big piles that are deposited on top of your plants.
Okay.
Which is not good. So we recommend a flail mower generally for mowing either the first year or the second year, because you are able to chop the material up and shred it, and it doesn't leave big piles behind.
Okay. A question from me, then. In my yard, my prairie is plagued with sumac.
Oh, boy. Okay.
Well. And we live about 20 feet off the Military Ridge bike trail, so I cannot control the source.
Right. So it creeps in by runners from the trail. Yes. You are going to have a lifetime maintenance program, and it really depends upon what you want it to look like. Now, one of the things you can do, and here, this is a good question, how to manage prairies. You can burn them.
I love doing.
Absolutely. That's the best part. Why do you think I do this? It's because I get to burn stuff.
I heard one of Neil's early talks about burning, and I think he's a secret pyro.
Oh, it's not a secret. Oh, no. This goes way back. I figured, hey, you know what? If I'm a pyro, I got to put it to good use. Let's do prairies.
Well, that's true. We could pretend it's on purpose then, and it's a good thing.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So for controlling your sumac, you can burn it, which will burn back the mature stems to the ground, and then they will resprout, usually the first year, 3 to 4 feet.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, they will then be a regular part of your prairie. And if you, like most people, burn your prairie every other year, then they will get up to 6 feet usually the second year, depending upon the soil and the growth rate. So you do have that kind of issue here with using fire, or you can mow them down. Okay, a lot of times you can't burn a prairie because it's in an urban area.
They've gotten upset with previous burns.
Yeah, well, you just do it about 2 o'clock in the morning when nobody's looking, but you didn't hear that from me.
No.
No.
Nobody's
no.
recording this, Neil.
But you can use mowing as an alternative to burning, and you want to mow it right down to the ground.
Right.
And the timing of mowing and burning is also very important. The big mistake people make is they do it too early. As soon as it's warm and the soil is dry, they want to go out and mow. So maybe they're out there at the end of March. But usually what you'll find is the best time to mow or burn your prairie is usually the latter part of April, after things have greened up, because usually the biggest problem we run into in prairies are non-native cool season weeds and grasses like quackgrass, bluegrass. Bluegrass is actually a weed in the prairie.
Yes, that's right.
Brome grass. Sometimes you'll have clovers that can really be aggressive. So what we do is we wait for them to green up. And usually around in southern Wisconsin, usually about the third or fourth week in April is when we will burn. And that then will damage those cool season grasses.
Okay, so
and in the case of your sumac, if the sumac is leafing out and we burn it then you do more damage to it because it's had to expend the reserves from its roots in order to make those new leaves.
Good idea.
So burning and mowing, timing is everything. And
so late April rather than, because I'm always nagging my husband every year, we got to get out there. And he's like, leave me alone.
Take your time, wait till it greens up, and then go for it. The other thing is, in your situation, you may actually have to go out there, and some people, if this is acceptable to you, you can cut the sumacs down in the summer or the fall, early fall, and put just a dab of Roundup, undiluted or 50% diluted Roundup on the cut stump, just drops. Okay, on the canvas.
Basically, kind of paint it even with a little paintbrush or something, or just
you can use a paintbrush. I put it in a liquid dish soap container.
Oh, sure, and then turn it upside down, drop.
Exactly.
Good idea.
And that way I don't have an open can that you could spill and make a big mess with.
Excellent.
Okay, so that works really well. And then that will translocate down in the root and kill the root. Hopefully it won't kill the DNR's plants on the trail, but it only goes usually about 6 or so feet.
Eight feet. Then we'd be fine. And there's some prairie remnants on that trail, so I actually think they might even be appreciative. But
excellent.
We won't get into that on air either. So let's take another call. This is from Green Bay. This is Jeff. Good morning, Jeff.
Good morning, Shelley. Good morning, Neil. Jeff Sanders here. How you been?
Good. How are you, Jeff?
Doing well.
Great.
Neil, I got a question for you. I'm a land use planner. I'm working with about 24 clients, mostly rural towns around Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm.
And over the course of the last 2 or 3 years, many of the communities I'm working with have expressed an interest in trying to do something locally to address global climate change. And one of the things I've been doing is recommending prairie restoration, the incorporation of prairies into their landscape.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about prairies and carbon sequestration.
That's a great question. And, you know, trees get all the attention. And this is classic. You know, there's like a pecking order in the plant world. Trees are at the top of the food chain, then shrubs, then flowers, and then you finally get down to things like grasses, ferns, and, you know, mosses are at the bottom somewhere, okay? So it's like
mosses.
It's like a social caste system, okay? So when people think global warming, oh, we'll plant trees to reduce global warming, and that's great. But as far as carbon sequestration, prairie plants actually are carbon sinks. And studies have shown that, on average, prairie grasses, about one-third of their roots, their fine feeder roots that they develop every year, about one-third of those will die every year in the soil. And those are what built these fantastic prairie soils. That's where the organic matter came from. So there's actually a net incorporation of carbon into the soil from most prairie plants. So they're a very good option as far as carbon sequestration.
Very good question.
Neil, always a pleasure hearing you. And Shelley, I can personally attest to Neil's desire to burn stuff. Have a great day, guys.
Thanks, Jeff.
Thanks, Jeff. I think that's another entire show that we're going to have to discuss here, Neil.
We can do that.
Well, let's go to Tim in Crandon. Tim, good morning.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Oh,
and
no
I wish, wish I knew half of what you guys know about this stuff. I don't want to sound repetitive to your earlier caller about the caterpillars, but we've got some milkweed and some butterfly plant that we've had in a bed, and we've always, from day one, had these green caterpillars with the black stripes. And you're talking this morning about these are maybe larvae for the butterfly. They've been extremely destructive. They about total out the plant, like before the thing even has a chance really to have any beauty at all. The plant is just totally chewed up. How do you know a good caterpillar from a bad one?
Good question.
That is really good, and there is a book that does actually identify caterpillars. Normally, you'll see butterfly books. They identify the butterfly, but there are books that actually identify the caterpillar, and there are some books that have both of the butterfly and the caterpillar. So, and I'm sorry, I cannot remember the name of it. Sitting in my office, I cannot remember the name of this book, but I bet if you go to Amazon.com and do a search for butterfly caterpillar books, it will come up. It's a little field guide. It's thin. It'll fit in your pocket, and it's a great guide. And one other thing, and this is a really important thing that you bring up here, is when you plant a prairie, especially if your goal is to attract birds and butterflies, it really requires a different approach to gardening, because if you want to support these different forms of wildlife, they are going to eat your plants. And I realize
right.
in your case, it sounds like it's pretty extreme where they're not leaving much. And I've seen that.
Yeah.
Okay. But when I go out and look at my garden, I see it's been munched on by caterpillars. As long as the whole plant isn't gone, I go, hooray, it's working. I'm able to support all these other cool creatures.
Right. You're bringing in this natural beauty.
Right. But it sounds like in your situation, they've kind of gotten out of control. And you will see that occasionally. Does that happen every year for you?
Yeah, we've had it now. This will be our fourth summer with this particular garden, and they've totally ruined this plant species every year. And these things are about half the size of my little finger, and about that round, kind of a beautiful color green with black stripes.
Well, you know what? I would get that caterpillar book and make an absolute positive ID.
Okay.
And see what you've got there. And if it's monarchs, you may just want to maybe plant some more plants.
Yeah.
Feed them somewhere. I don't know. It's a
really,
hard call.
Because it's a toss-up. You have to decide the plants or the butterflies. And in this case, especially, I think the butterfly population is so fragile that I would be sacrificing plants. But I have a suggestion to make. If you go to www.prairienursery.com, you can get in touch with Neil, and you can get the exact name of this butterfly book, or this caterpillar book, too. Okay?
Yeah,
I'll do that, and I'll email you tonight. And I've got just a sub-question to that, if I can ask it.
Sure.
This particular bed is about, I'd say maybe 20 feet long and 10 feet wide. And, of course, being in Crandon, our summer is not what it is southern part of the state. And it's much in the shade. There's two big maple trees that are in the middle of this bed that do give it a lot of shade. Can you give me any kind of ideas on turning this thing into like a grass prairie type of bed, or do beds not make a wise choice to go prairie and wild grasses and things?
Beds are great for prairie grass and flower gardens. I think that the issue you're going to run into here is the shade. And you're going to, it's very important when you look at selecting plants, you want to select plants that'll match your soil, whether it's a sandy soil or a clay soil or a loamy soil, whether it's wet, dry, or medium good soil, and the amount of sunlight. And it's so important for you to select plants that will match all of those conditions. So how much sun do you get there on average? A half a day or more than a half a day?
I'd say probably 8 hours, and then, you know, and that's midsummer. I mean, and it takes a long time. We're talking middle to the end of June through probably the 1st of September is its, you know, best sun that it's ever going to get. You know, that's a pretty short season.
Yeah, and you know, the other thing is, where is it located with regards to the shade? Is it on the north side of the shade or the south side of the shade, east side, west side?
It's the north side of the yard, and, yeah. And it's got a complete opening to the south.
Oh, to the south. Okay, so you get sun coming in under the trees in that area in the spring and the fall?
Correct.
Okay, see, that's better than if it was on the north side, because then the trees would block the sun, and you would have a completely different situation. The north side of a tree or the north side of a forest will be much shadier than the south side, because you won't get that sun coming in the spring and the fall when the sun is low in the sky.
And there's a difference, like you're saying, between morning sun and afternoon sun, particularly in August.
Big difference. In fact, yeah. If you're planting around a house, the more sensitive plants and the more drought-sensitive plants you should generally put on the east side. And the more drought-tolerant plants you put on the west side, because what happens in the morning when the sun comes up? There's dew on the plants, which helps to reduce the water stress on them. The temperatures are lower in the morning, so you don't have as much heat stress on the plants. But by the afternoon, when that sun is pounding on the west side of the house, oh boy, those plants, the air is hotter and drier, and there's the sun just burning them up. So you want to be very careful with regards to where you position your plants, and you select the plants to match the soil conditions and sun conditions. And we have a broad offering of plants for shade. And again, if you want to, you can go to our website and check that out. You can get one of our catalogs, whatever is easiest. And there's a wide selection of plants for sun shade and semi-shade conditions. General rule of thumb, if you don't have a half a day of full sun, don't plant most prairie plants. They need at least a half a day of full sun.
And, you know, best advice would be to get out there, Tim, and actually measure the amount. Is it truly 8 hours? Is it 6 hours? And put together a chart for the different months of the year, and that will help you decide what to plant. And going on, Neil, you also have something else that plants very nicely into a shady lawn situation instead of prairie plants. And I'm talking about another one of my favorites, the no-mow mix.
Oh, the no-mow lawn mix. Yeah, that's a really great thing, especially if you don't like mowing.
Yeah.
I hate mowing.
Yeah.
Okay, and my goal is to not mow. And that's where that was the big motivation for this is, I need some areas where I have some low-growing grass.
Right, okay? And it's a little too shady to put in the prairie plants, so what do we do to make it look natural?
You can use this no-mow lawn mix. It's a combination of fine fescue, 6 different fine fescue grasses. They're slow-growing. They do not require much fertilizer. They're low nitrogen feeders. And it will break that crazy cycle that you want to talk about excellent marketing? The lawn cycle. Okay, I put in the lawn. I put in the traditional lawn mix. And then I fertilize it so it will grow faster so I can mow it more often so I can remove all the materials and create thatch. But then I have to dethatch and then dispose of that. It's an amazing thing. The marketing is brilliant.
And it's a lot of work.
It's a lot of work. So if you plant the no-mow, what most of our customers will do, it will send up a seed stock in June. Most people will mow it at about, at the highest level on their mower, usually about 5-6 inches, mm-hmm. not 5 inches usually, 4 to 5, mow at once. And this is for a non-traditional area. This is for like an area in the back where you don't, it doesn't have to be very manicured, okay? You mow it once a year. Okay, I have areas in my house I haven't mowed for 3 or 4 years. Okay, and in the shade, it will not send up a flower stalk.
No, it doesn't.
It doesn't have enough energy from the sun. So those areas, really, the only reason you mow it is if you start to see some woody plants start to come into it or something like that. I just go and pull them out if it's a small area. So.
What I like about it is if you go hiking into the deep woods, you'll see these patches of this kind of pale green delicate lawn or grasses. And that's what no-mow looks like. It looks like you're in a dense, deep part of a forest. So it's a very natural look.
It really is. It will grow in moderate shade. It won't grow in deep shade. I use it for trails in my woods under the oaks. Mm-hmm. The one thing you have to be careful when you plant in the shade, you must either rake off the leaves in the fall after they fall, or go through with a mulching mower and really chop those leaves up, because if you allow them to get kind of plastic.
We're back to smothering.
Yeah, it will smother over the winter, and then you'll have big problems the next year.
Well, let's take another call. This is from Madison. Is it Graham?
Yes, this is Graham.
Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have two questions. We've had a lot of luck in our yard getting monarchs every for the last 3 years by planting the butterfly bushes. And the milkweed. And last year, we had quite a few. I saw the caterpillars and their eggs underneath the milkweed. But after about a week or so, they'd be gone, and I think something's been eating them or something. Is there anything I can do to keep them from, getting eaten?
That's a good question, because the monarch caterpillar is well known for being toxic, and so birds will generally leave it alone, and it gets this toxin from eating the milkweed plant.
Could it be my dogs?
I think they probably wouldn't like them. I don't know. Now myself, I've never eaten a monarch caterpillar. Maybe that's something I should try, but I haven't done that. I mean, who knows? Dogs, you know, they're pretty omnivorous. They don't really seem to care. I would be surprised if they were being predated upon, because that's rather unusual, unless there's some creature that somehow is able to eat them. I don't know.
I really don't know.
I'm assuming you're not spraying anything, right? No.
Oh, no, we don't spray anything in our yard.
Okay, that's the only thing I can think of right off the bat. But,
I'll check my neighbors, though, because it is the area where the butterflies are, like in the corner of the yard. I wonder if my neighbors are spraying something.
We forget to look across our boundaries. That's a very good idea.
Yes, and you can get drift from that. And, you know, it's amazing. If you spray insecticides, herbicides, pesticides on even a slightly windy day, especially on a warm day when the chemicals can volatilize, they can go like 50 feet or more
as an
aerosol. So it can very easily come from your neighbors, and that's why if you're ever using that kind of stuff, you do it when there's little or no wind and on cool conditions, so you don't get volatilization and drift onto your neighbors or onto desirable plants and animals.
I wonder if I have good neighbors, so I'll ask them.
Yeah, because, I mean, again, they just may not know what Neil just said.
Right.
You know, the only other thing that I'm making a stretch here is I've had some strange cats in my day, and sometimes they sit out there under the plants in the shade, and if they saw something moving slowly, like a caterpillar or something that looked abnormal, they might be pawing at it or knocking it off.
Who knows? I've
seen stranger things in my yard. I mean, you talk about not eating monarch caterpillars or chrysalis. Last week, my kid ate cat food. So, you know, you just never know what's going to happen in the world. thanks for that call and that little aside. The next call is Tim from Kenosha. Good morning, Tim.
Good morning. Neil, good to talk to you.
Hi, Tim. How are you?
I'm good.
Good.
You helped me out about 30 years ago.
Oh, not quite, but it was back there. Yeah, it was a while ago. Yes, I remember it very clearly. You bet.
All right. Since then, I've expanded my meadow an acre back, and I have a really nice planting going. But I have a dilemma, however, in that I have quite a bit of bird's foot trefoil, which I kind of like because I'm raising bees as well.
Mm-hmm.
Makes a great forage, but it seems to be pretty difficult to control, and I'm wondering if you'd have any ideas as to how to manage that a little bit.
Yeah, that can be problematic, Tim. Bird's foot trefoil is a non-native legume.
Right.
It tends to do well in acid, sandy soils, but you, as I recall, you have kind of a really beautiful loamy soil.
Heavy clay.
Yeah. Yep. And at least you don't have crown vetch.
Right.
Because that is far worse. Another legume, non-native legume, that was planted primarily for highway embankment erosion control. And it does a great job of that, but it's almost impervious to being killed because it creeps by rhizomes, it seeds in, it's resistant to Roundup, it's a bad news plant. Your trefoil is not as bad as crown vetch, but it can be fairly aggressive too.
Right.
Have you been burning your prairie, Tim?
Yes, I've burned it once.
Okay, what time of year did you burn it?
Spring, and I tried to wait until the bird's foot trefoil was up, and it did control it a little, and maybe that's the key.
If you can burn it, let's see, because you're probably looking at last week in April.
Right.
By you there in Kenosha.
Yep.
If you can, and the best way to tell, every spring is different. We use the sugar maple tree as our guide because the plants never lie. They're all kind of coordinated with each other. When the buds of the sugar maple are just breaking open, not when the leaves are fully out, that's a little bit late. When they're just starting to break open, then that is when the best time to burn.
Okay, I think we lost him. Oh, I did.
Yep.
Was there any more, Tim?
That should do it. The burning should keep that under control, though.
If you can burn late enough.
Yeah. Okay.
Now, I don't think you're ever going to get rid of it.
Right.
Okay.
Well, no, I'm not sure I want to.
Yeah.
Well, it sounds like the bees like it, too. So, you know, sometimes you have to compromise a little bit.
And it's low growing. So, if your prairie's going to grow up over it by July, so it'll be a pretty much a non-factor by then.
Right, right.
Okay. Well, good luck. Good to talk to you.
You bet. Talk to you.
Bye.
Bye. Gee, do you know everybody's backyard in Wisconsin, Neil?
Only half of them, yeah.
Well, we'll have to get you out so you can tell me what I did wrong with my prairie. Let's see. We've talked about sumac, quackgrass. We're doing a good job on my prairie, too.
We can do that.
Now, one thing you haven't talked about that I know that I in previous conversations, alternating burning and mowing.
Oh, this is really important. For a number of reasons. There's a lot of controversy about how often should you burn a prairie?
It's fun to do it every 5 minutes, but...
How often should you mow? How often should you burn? When? All this kind of stuff. And I should preface all this spring burning. If you have a dry prairie, like a dry lime prairie, what they call a goat prairie on a steep, dry slope like they have over by the Mississippi River, or if you have a really sandy prairie, these tend to have early blooming plants like lupines and passflowers and prairie smoke. And this late April burning does not work for that because those flowers will be in full bloom. Usually when we're dealing...
Good point. That's right. We're dealing with the later stuff on the clay soils.
Exactly. And that's what most people have. Okay, but you get into what we call a mesic prairie or a medium soil prairie. Those are the ones you burn in late April, maybe even early May if you're in northern Wisconsin. But if you have a dry prairie with early blooming flowers, typically the best way to manage that is to burn them in the fall when those plants are not active. And you usually don't have nearly the same problem with invasive non-native plants in a dry prairie because of the dry growing conditions. Just doesn't support that many weeds. But as far as how often to burn, a lot of people will say never burn. Okay, because it damages invertebrates, especially butterflies, moths, etc. Okay, other people will say, burn every 5 minutes.
That was me.
Okay. If there's fuel out there and it's dry, let's burn it. Okay, but what I have found is, and you have to look at why do you burn. Okay, the main reason that we burn is to control undesirable plants. That's our magic bullet.
And it doesn't harm the prairie plants. It's part of their natural life cycle.
They evolved under those conditions because people, you know, the prairie people probably evolved together because Native Americans burned the prairie as a land management strategy to keep the land open for better hunting.
Right.
So these plants had to respond to those conditions, and I'm sure lightning played a factor before people were here 15,000 years ago or whatever it was. So you have plants that are fully adapted to these conditions. So what we do is what we have found is that your biggest problem is you get too much growth of cool season grasses and weeds, which start growth up to 4 weeks before most of your more heat-loving, warm season prairie plants. So that's why we let the bad guys green up.
That's why we wait a little longer. We wait till the buds on the maple tree are out.
Exactly. Sugar maple.
Sugar maple.
Not the silver maple.
That's
not
right,
the red maple. Okay, the sugar maple, which
so
is the last maple.
Next we'll do a tree identification then.
There we go. Excellent. But when the when those plants are up about usually 3 to 5, maybe 6 inches, okay, usually about the second time you're going to mow your lawn, okay, that's usually
that's
when
a good
burn.
Rule of thumb.
Usually
excellent,
the
yeah.
second time you mow the lawn, that's when you burn, okay, and that then knocks back all that early green growth, which damages the undesirable plants, and the soil turns black. Okay, which then absorbs the heat of the sun, thus changing
up
the whole growing environment in the soil, which really drives plant activity is the root temperature, okay, to a large degree, not so much the air temperature, but the soil temperature. Then the prairie plants really get going, and now they have the advantage over the non-native cool season weeds like quackgrass, bluegrass,
so they can compete better.
They are in the driver's seat. Now, how often should you do that? What we have found is, and I live on a 20-acre buckthorn farm, so I have to be very careful about invasion. Okay. So the areas where I've converted to prairie, I burn them every other year in rotation. And if I wait 3 years, non-desirable woody plant seedlings can become established. If I burn every other year, it's very rare that a woody plant can become established in my prairie.
And then what are you doing those other years? Mowing?
No, actually, I'm just leaving them stand.
Leaving it go.
Okay. Yes, and this is really good because with the areas that you leave unburned, those will then serve as refugia for the chrysalises and the eggs of butterflies and other invertebrates. If you burn everything, you lose all your next generation. Okay?
Okay.
And certain birds like freshly burned or freshly mowed open areas, others like dead standing vegetation.
So half and half each time. Great idea. We are talking with Neil DeBole of Prairie Nursery. If you'd like to get in line for some calls on Garden Talk, call 1-800-642-1234 or 263-1890 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. And this is Garden Talk. I'm Shelley Ryan sitting in for Larry Mueller, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're back with Garden Talk. Our guest is Neil DeBole of Prairie Nursery. We're talking at the moment burning and mowing. Neil, just to recap on that a little bit, I had thought that you're supposed to burn every other year and then mow every other year. It sounds like you're leaving parts of it standing so that there is a place for the critters to go.
If your goal is invertebrates like butterflies, mm-hmm. Sphinx moths, and you know, generally insects in general. then it is to your advantage not to mow or burn everything down in any given year, to leave half of it stand.
Okay.
Now, some people don't like that because it looks ugly, okay, all that dead grass, okay? So some people like to either burn everything or mow everything. If you're going to do that, then, you know, maybe burn it one year and mow it the next year.
Okay, because, so that's, we're not harming things by doing it that way. But
well, it's not as good as leaving it stand because when you mow everything down and you do kind of mush everything up.
You're still not saving any. Okay.
You're still doing damage, but what you don't want to do is if you burn your prairie every single year, you will push the equilibrium of that ecosystem more towards grasses and a few selected flowers. And this is a problem. People that burn their prairie every year, 10 years later, they go, all I have is grasses. Where'd my flowers go? It's because they didn't rest it for a year because burning tends to favor the prairie grasses in general.
So
that's why every year rotation
is a good idea.
Hey, it works as far as keeping woody plants out, controlling cool season weeds, and maintaining diversity of wildlife, as well as diversity of flowers and grasses.
Okay, then we're almost correct in our own backyard. We'll just keep playing with that. Let's go to another caller. This is Matt from Milwaukee. Good morning, Matt.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a question. I don't know if you'll be able to answer it or not, but I have collected a small number of seeds from several different plants that are considered weed species, and I'm interested in growing them, and I'm wondering if I need to treat them with a period of cold before they will grow. The plants are blackberry, plantain, dandelion, red clover, and purslane.
Okay, blackberry, comma, plantain, is that correct? Or blackberry plantain?
No, blackberry, comma,
okay.
Plantain.
Okay.
And purslane, you said?
Pardon me?
You said purslane?
Purslane, yep, dandelion, and red clover.
Why are you saving these would be my first question.
Well, a lot of plants that people call weeds actually have a high amount of nutritional and or medicinal value.
Mm-hmm. That's what I wondered. Mm-hmm. Well, and I eat dandelion and purslane, so I know where you're going with that.
Okay.
You can't beat purslane for vitamins A and C.
Oh, and the flavor.
Oh, yeah. Don't let it get too old and rubbery, though. Anyway, yeah. Yeah, dandelion shoots are fantastic, phenomenal for vitamins. I can't speak to dandelion, but purslane, that stuff seems to grow no matter what.
Okay.
You had also blackberry, you know, blackberry seeds, I don't know. You know, that's a really good question. I've never grown blackberries from seed.
Okay.
Those might need some kind of cold treatment. I'm only guessing here. And you had which other species?
Let's see. I think...
Plantain.
I have plantain. I'm not sure if this is the correct pronunciation, but I know there's two types of plantain. I think I've got the Plantago major with the broadleaves.
Yep, that's what that is, yes.
Okay.
And do you have the lanceolata, the narrow one, too?
I don't.
Okay. You know, I've never cultivated those, so I don't know if the plantains would require any cold treatment. Most weeds, they're pretty indiscriminate about their growing conditions.
Okay.
Now, that doesn't mean that they don't need some kind of treatment, because some do exhibit higher germination, and I don't know if there are obligate requirements for cold treatment on those, but I would be very surprised if you had any problems with the purslane. That seems to grow no matter what.
Now, is the plantain, isn't that biennial?
It depends on the species.
You get the basal flowers the first year and then the little stalks the second
year?
Yeah,
you know, that's a good question. I'm not cultivating those.
Usually we're trying to get rid of them, but, you know, like...
Maybe our caller knows. Are those biennials or are they short-lived perennials?
That I don't know. I am actually in the process of learning about all this, so I'm not an expert.
You know, I wouldn't be surprised if the Plantagos... I think some of those are short-lived perennials, but I'm not absolutely positive on that. Of course, the purslane is an annual.
I'm going to throw in a piece of advice just because I work with somebody and have had somebody on the show who on my show on Wisconsin Public Television, and we focused on some of the wild edibles and the medicinal properties and the health benefits. You might check out Red Sage Health in Madison.
Okay.
Because Laurel Redman, who works there, grows a lot of those and harvests a lot of those and fed me one of the best dandelion meals I've ever had in my life.
Oh, excellent.
So she might also have either if she can't answer it, I know she has some excellent resources for that kind of information.
You don't happen to know either a phone number or a website, do you?
Not off the top of my head, but I think if you even Google search Red Sage in Madison, it's on, what is it? It's right next to the Willie Street Co-op.
Great.
So it's on Willie Street. That helps narrow it down a little bit.
Okay. Well, I appreciate all your help.
Well, good luck with that.
You too. Take care.
That's an interesting question. I like when we get on the little sidebars, you know.
Well, you know, things like dandelion and purslane, there's more vitamin per leaf than anything you can buy in the store.
I know. I mean, we always think of oranges as the big deal, and I'm watching our engineer Joe making faces at us through the window. Dandelions are good to eat.
Hey, and you can make dandelion wine too.
Actually, yes, you can. And I had a neighbor that did that, and she added oranges and lemons to it, and didn't know that. That the alcohol goes straight to the fruit, and so she was down there one morning eating all the fruit. And as she, one of my great dear friends, and as she said, next thing I know, I couldn't get up the stairs. So as you make dandelion wine, don't eat the fruit. But actually, I sneak dandelion greens into casseroles all the time because they're just so good for you. And we've got... Okay, I'm hearing from Joe now. He's not a dandelion lover, but he's not a dandelion hater either, but he's not a dandelion eater. We're going to have to convert Joe, I think. But we're getting on off to the side here, but I'm going to bring you in a bunch of dandelions and make you eat them. Actually, just sautéed even with bacon is wonderful.
Yes,
you know, but I put them into Mexican casseroles, and nobody knows the difference. let's stop digressing. We'll go to another caller. This is Patricia in Baraboo. Good morning.
Good morning. I have kind of two questions, but they both have to do with the front yard. When we bought our house 10 years ago, there was actually a tall grass prairie in the front yard, and we are in the city. And it's been interesting to try to contain it just in terms of other people's reactions to it. And frankly, I don't know what to do about it. I'm outside of taking it out, and I feel kind of badly about that. But I would never have put a tall grass prairie in the front yard. The other thing that is somewhat connected to it is we have a 66 by 132 lot, but we have 26 trees on it, mostly mature trees. We're kind of like a little house in the woods, but the sun does hit that prairie spot. But we have a sugar maple that we've cabled, and we last year we had, I'm not sure I'm going to say this correctly, the cambriate stat put around the bottom of it to try to slow down the growth, and the top of the tree is dying back. Anyway, it's just a beautiful sugar maple tree. But also there's a silver maple in the front yard, two hemlocks and a Norway spruce.
Wow.
So I think we have real rich soil. And I'm just not sure how to handle everything. I'm afraid to do anything near the sugar maple for fear of disturbing it further. There is grass. We don't have to mow very often.
Mm-hmm.
Do I take the prairie out? Am I going to disturb the sugar maple? Should I? Any idea? Hire you to come out and look.
We can do that.
Patricia, first of all, did you say the sugar maple is dying back?
Well, it is. It's
way up at the top?
We've been watching it, right, and it has. We were concerned because it seemed like we saw a crack in it, and it's just a beloved tree. We had eagles actually land in it.
Oh, wow.
We weren't home, but all the neighbors came over, so it's just truly a beautiful in form. But I know it's dying, and we're trying to do everything we can to prevent it.
Okay, the my first concern, and then we'll tie in with the prairie here with Neil too. But there is also an issue of root rot. And
I've had a few people look at it, but no one has mentioned that. I mean, I've had some really good arborists, I think,
as long as you've got, I mean, it's especially when you see slow dieback from the crown, if you see early fall color,
mm-hmm.
Are signs usually of a root rot, and it'll take it, many, many years to die. But it's also something that if it was that, it's fixable. There are some chemicals that you can spread, have a professional spread, and control it. So if you for your information, if you want to research that more, I'm going to send you to my website for the Wisconsin Gardener,
okay.
Which is wpt.org/garden.
Okay.
And then from there, we have a direct link to extension.
Okay.
And what you want to do is you're going to want to get in touch with the plant pathologist, Brian Huddleston.
Okay.
And he can basically tell you how to take a sample of the roots.
Okay.
Because the first thing is, if it has root rot and you don't treat it, it will die.
Mm-hmm.
And it sounds like it's a very precious tree, so I'd be focusing on saving that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And now we can segue right into the prairie, Neil.
Okay. How much sun is your prairie getting?
Well, it gets west sun.
So you get a half a day?
We must, because everything blooms and it seems very happy.
Okay. Okay, and as Shelley was pointing out, one thing about maples in general, they have very superficial roots.
Right.
Very close to the soil. Right. So you have to be really careful. You don't slice into those, because then if you disturb the roots, disease organisms like fungi, et cetera, can enter. But as far as the prairie itself, you bring up an excellent point. When we do designs for our clients, and we do a lot of designs, installations, et cetera, we would rarely put a tall prairie in a front yard, okay, unless the client requested it, because you want to make sure and size the plants appropriate for the space in which they're being used.
Sure.
So in a situation like yours, we would use some of the shorter prairie grasses, like little blue stem or prairie drop seed, with some of the lower growing flowers, like some of the blazing stars, the butterfly weed, nodding pink onion. There's a wide variety from which to choose that only get maybe 2 or 3 feet tall. Mm-hmm. But be that as it may, do you have flowers in there that you want to preserve?
Well, there's some Joe Pye weed, spider's wort. Mm-hmm. But there is, cup plant and big blue stem and corn flowers galore and brown-eyed Susans, black-eyed Susans. There is some blazing star also.
And the neighbors are the ones that are kind of causing your concern?
Well, there was just someone around the block. And actually it resulted in sort of looking at a whole ordinance for prairies, which was a positive thing, actually.
Oh, good.
But it was, a little difficult. And I'm just between that sugar maple, which is right next to it, and, should I just leave the prairie as it is now till we figure out that maple? I just hesitate to. I would like to get rid of the grass under the sugar maple, but I'm hesitant to do anything.
Just one quick question, then we're out of time, or one quick idea, and we can come back and discuss this some more when we come back. I would think mow a path through it and make it look a little bit more controlled and pretend it's a garden.
We have some options we can discuss. When we come back, we'll talk about that.
Okay. Okay. We are talking with Neil DeVol of Prairie Nursery, and we will be checking news from National Public Radio in just a moment. But first, a few more bits about prairies, and we'll be talking about maybe how to turn a tall grass prairie into a prairie garden, and we'll take more of your calls as well. I'm Shelley Ryan. I'm the host of The Wisconsin Gardener on Wisconsin Public Television, and my next show is on May 15th on Wisconsin Public Television. I'm sitting in today for Larry Mueller, and I'm on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We'll be back in just a few minutes. Good afternoon. You're listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Shelley Ryan, host of The Wisconsin Gardener on Wisconsin Public Television, and I'm actually very proud of myself. I don't think I've called you folks viewers yet today, so we're doing good. I'm sitting in for Larry Mueller, and we'll be talking until 12:30 with Neil DeVol of Prairie Nursery. And we'll get right back to the phones in just a minute. The number is 1-800-642-1234, and in the Madison area, 263-1890. And Neil, we're trying to finish up on a previous call. The woman had a tall grass prairie in her front yard. I suggested mowing around it to make it look a little bit more like a garden, but you had some other ideas too.
You can certainly mow around it or mow a path through it, like you said. What you can also do is you can selectively remove some of the larger plants. For instance, she mentioned she had big blue stem, which is a tall prairie grass, which can get 6 to 8 feet tall, and she has cup plant, which can get anywhere from 6 to 12 feet tall. So
that spreads a little bit, doesn't it?
It spreads. Both of them actually are very successful by seed. So these are not the kind of plants that we would normally include in a front yard garden. Maybe in the backyard somewhere along a fence line where we wanted a screen. Those are perfect for that. But in the front yard, probably not your best choices. Great plants in their proper place.
Well, in fact, if she digs them up, she can call me and I'll take them.
She could dig them up. The only problem with that is now, once they're mature, they have humongous
They're
roots.
Huge, yeah.
So
need a truck and a backhoe, maybe.
That's exactly right. A dump truck and a backhoe. Now, most people aren't going to do that. What she can do, if she's very careful and she doesn't mind using herbicides, and some people do and some people don't, so you want to be very sensitive to this, but she can go in there in August, or actually probably the best time would be to go in there late mid-July and cut those undesirable plants back to the ground and then let them resprout so you get fresh new growth, and let it grow for about another month, and then you go in and very carefully treat them with a solution of Roundup, which will then translocate down to the roots and kill those plants out. But you have to be exceedingly, exceedingly careful that you don't have any drift onto other plants
right
next door, like we talked about, or right next door. One thing you can do with that is you can rig up a 5-gallon plastic pail and just cut the bottom out of it and put that over the plants you want to kill and just spray in there, and then the herbicide stays inside there and only gets on the leaves of the plants you're trying to kill.
Oh, that's an excellent idea.
So, and then you let it sit for a while, and as soon as it dries, then you can pick the pail up and go on to the next plant.
Right, and the herbicides, once they're dry, they're safe to all of us.
As far as Roundup goes.
Right,
okay,
right.
Now there's all kinds of herbicides.
Right, there's some very lethal ones out there. You know, rule of thumb, always read the instructions.
Read the label.
Yeah.
Read the label, read the label.
We tend to not. You know, we get out there and we think more is better, and it's the same with fertilizer. More is not necessarily better.
And if you don't read the instructions, you might end up with destruction. So
right,
you want to be really, really careful.
Right, and as gardeners, make mistakes, but let's not add to that list if we don't have to. Well, let's take another call. This is from Illinois, and this is Charlotte. Good morning. Good afternoon, I should say.
Hi there. This is about the monarch butterfly larva disappearing.
Yeah.
I read somewhere, and I don't know all the particulars because I can't find the article. I'm sorry, but maybe it'll spark someone else's memory. I think there's a parasitic fly that will infest either the egg or the very young larva. And it gets some kind of a disease where the larva quits eating and starts wandering when it's way too small yet to pupate. And then, of course, it dies, and you never get a chrysalis. And I have already marked the leaf, you know, it has a little hole where the guy's starting to eat, and the hole won't get any bigger. Now look and look, you can't find the worm at all. I brought the eggs in on the leaf in the house and would have them leave the leaf way too early and wander. So I'm kind of wondering if they even lay this disease in the egg itself. So maybe someone else will have an idea, but I think it's a parasitic fly that causes the damage.
Thank you for that information, Charlotte.
Mm-hmm. That's great. And there are a number of parasitic flies and parasitic wasps that do exactly
that's
that.
That's right. I didn't even... And it rings a bell. There's something I've read somewhere. So, in fact, if any entomologists are listening, they're welcome to call and help us out with this question, too. Let's go on to Jeff in Milwaukee. Hi, Jeff.
Hi. I have a question about my milkweed plants. I have quite a few different milkweed plants in my garden, but in the summer, they're usually covered with a bug. It looks exactly like a box elder bug when it's young and when it's older. However, the pattern is different. It's like it's got a different paint job, brighter orange and black instead of the red, and bigger spots. And I tried to find it online. It seems to be listed as a milkweed bug, but I've never been able to really find anything else out about it.
Boy, that's a good question. I am not an entomologist.
Neil and I are nodding at each other like, you take that one. No, yeah. You take that one.
What we will often see on milkweeds are aphids.
But
aphids love milkweeds,
yes,
but this
do.
Is obviously not what you're talking
Big
about.
Aphids,
I mean, when
no.
they start out, the plants are completely covered with huge mm-hmm. clusters of these little orange soft bodies, just like the milkweed, mm-hmm. or like a box elder bug.
Yeah.
The teeny tiny little, teeny tiny orange babies you're
right.
talking about.
And they just keep growing and growing, you know, they're... Like I said, the plants are covered with them.
Are they doing damage? Are they eating them, or are they the sucking?
They don't seem to do a lot of damage to the plant, but I don't want to spray them.
Yeah.
Right, because
then
you
end up hurting the milkweed, or
right.
the monarch caterpillars.
Right.
You know, again, I'm going to suggest, I think they are box elders, and because there is some color variation, I think. I'm going to direct you back to my website, which is WPT, for Wisconsin Public Television, .org/garden. And then at that website, we have a direct link to Extension. And they have a number of bug pictures.
Okay. Yeah, this, like I said, the body looks identical, except, you know, the box elder bug has that zigzag stripe across its back.
Yeah.
These are orange, large orange spots, you know, rounded.
We have a number of insect fact sheets on that website, and I think that would be an excellent place to start. And if you can't get that, then I think you can also, I believe, contact Phil Pelletieri through that website or email him and get answers.
Okay.
So that would be where I'd send you, because I'd hate to give you wrong information. So thank you, Jeff. We're going to go on. We're going up north to Sturgeon Bay, and this is it Ellie?
Yes.
Hi.
Hi.
What, how can we help you?
Well, a while ago you were talking about getting rid of the bird's foot trefoil, and the comment was made that it's easier to get rid of than emerald crown vetch. Well, I'm the one with emerald crown vetch.
Oh, boy.
Hey, it could be worse. It could be poison ivy.
Right, yeah.
And you want to get rid of it?
Yes.
Okay, is it an area where you have desirable plants that you want to preserve adjacent or mixed in with it, or is it just an area that you want to get rid of it, period?
Well, they are adjacent about 3 feet away. I have a rock garden 5 feet away, maybe.
Okay, but they're not mixed in with the...
Okay, that's good.
Okay, there's really... there's three ways you can do this. One is to smother it for about 17 years. No, I should take that.
Okay, that's about half the time it's been in.
Yeah.
See, there you go. You're already ahead of the game.
No, for usually, with most plants, if you smother them with an impermeable layer of whether it's cardboard or newspapers with leaf clippings or black plastic or old silo casing in those ground silos, if you can smother for one full growing season from April through October, you will kill almost any plant there is except Canada thistle, bindweed, and possibly crown vetch. It's a tough one. It may take 2 years. What you can do is, if you want, just leave it there for 2 years, and then you know at the end of 2 years it'll be dead. Another option is to go in there with a rototiller and till it about every 3 to 4 weeks. As soon as you till it, then it'll send up new sprouts, new shoots about 1 or 2 inches tall that starts to exhaust the resources in the root. You till it again. You'll do that for a couple of years. Or you can use herbicides, which is usually faster, but then you have to use herbicides. It's a personal choice. But Roundup alone will not work, and so you'll need to use a combination of Roundup with a broadleaf herbicide such as 2,4-D, which is commonly used on turf to manage broadleaf weeds like dandelion, etc. That combination will be much more effective against the crown vetch.
Oh, it will. Okay.
Yes,
because I noticed last year the Roundup was not doing it.
You need the heavy-duty stuff.
I think the Roundup just fertilizes it.
Yes, I think so, too.
But then with your rock garden being close, remember drift. You know, maybe
right.
Even if you're really concerned, put up a big piece of cardboard or something so that you're not touching them at all.
Oh, or okay. Do it in the evening before the dew sets in.
You
don't want dew on the leaves because that will dilute the herbicide and make it less effective. So in the evening, you tend to have very low winds. So do it in the evening. And another thing is evening herbicides. I learned this just from using herbicides at our nursery that an area that I sprayed in the morning, then the wind picked up. I had to quit. Only got the job half done. I came back in the evening and did the other half. The area that I sprayed in the evening died much faster than the
area.
Really? Yes. Now, why is that? Look at plant physiology. In the morning, the plants are going to work. Okay, they're sending the energy from the roots up to the leaves. So the translocation of the herbicide is not as powerfully down as
down to the roots.
In the evening, what are they doing? They're going home from work.
Okay.
So they're sending the energy down from the leaves into the roots for storage at the end of the day, and it takes the herbicide down with it. And I was amazed. I was like, wow, this is so obvious from a plant physiology standpoint.
Yeah, it is.
But nobody ever tells you that. But indeed, if you spray in the evening, it's cool, you know, the wind is not blowing generally, and you'll get faster kill.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Good luck.
You're welcome. You know, that brings up another point. I've been told, especially with things like sumac and other, you know, more vigorous plants, to apply the Roundup in the fall when they're putting all their energy into the fall roots.
You know, this is what I've always believed, but you know what? Read the Roundup label.
Really?
What does the Roundup label say? The Roundup label says that the best time to do it
is when they're actively growing
after the leaves have fully expanded, usually in mid to late summer.
You know, that's a good thing we're talking about it then, because I've heard many people say that in the fall, you know, they're putting their energy into the roots. They are, but they're no longer actively growing. They're getting ready for nap time.
I have always believed that too, but I will tell you this. I will give you empirical data. I don't have time that time of year to go kill my mostly buckthorn, okay? So usually I end up doing my buckthorn, around March 30th.
Close to fall.
In fact, this March 30th, Sunday, a friend is coming up, and we're going to do our annual buckthorn jihad. So, but what I have found is that as long as the sap is not rising in the spring, that I have been successful in killing woody plants, most woody plants.
Excellent.
From midsummer all the way until late winter, as long as the sap is not rising. And
okay.
How do you tell? If you cut that stump,
and it
okay,
oozes.
And it oozes, give it about 3 minutes. Okay? If it starts to ooze up, then you're too late going into spring, and the herbicide will not translocate down. It'll just bubble up, and you'll waste your time.
You know, I don't know if this helps at all, but I know that there's an organization in Mineral Point, Shake Rag Alley, that is teaching people how to make furniture out of buckthorn.
Really?
So it's another way to get rid of the weed. You
Excellent.
Can sit on it.
It has beautiful orange wood and heartwood.
Yeah, it's very pretty.
It's really nice. Yeah, but I don't think I'm going to grow a plantation of buckthorn. Got one.
Yeah, this is to get rid of what you've already got, perhaps, you know. Cut it down and do something with it.
Yeah.
Well, let's take another call. This is Steve in Appleton. Hi, Steve.
Hi. First, a little thing that I do, just kind of a tip. I got one of those big old plastic bladder buster cups from a grocery store or from a convenience store, cut a hole in the end of it. I put that down over the plant I want to kill and then spray in the top of it.
Yep.
So it doesn't drift anywhere.
Yep.
There you go.
The cone of destruction. Yep.
Okay. Otherwise, I'm trying to find out a type of plant that I can put around my house that won't grow any taller than 8 inches but that is good for the butterflies.
Eight inches.
Reason for this is I had a nice wildflower garden for about 3 years in the city. Somebody complained about it. The city came along the week of the 4th of July last year and cut it right down to the ground, exposed the roots and all. So I'm sure it's dead. They even charged me $208 for the fun of it. They told me anything that isn't woody that grows over 8 inches tall is not legal in the city of Appleton.
How interesting. That means that you can't have any flowers in your flower beds?
I asked them about that. They told me I have to weed eat the top off my tulips when they're done flowering.
Wow.
These people are crazy.
You said it. That's a little restrictive.
Interesting. That's very, very strange.
Yeah, they cut down my irises. They cut down my daylilies. They cut down the wildflower garden. You know, everything that was over 8 inches.
This sounds like a lawsuit waiting to happen, but that's not my expertise. So one plant that you might want to consider is the species, many species of violet. Because violets are not so great as a nectar plant, but they are host plants for the larva of a few butterflies. Not a lot, but a few. So you could consider violets. But it's not going to give you really the broad-ranging diversity that you would want. And I'm assuming this is a full sun area you're working with here. Is that correct?
What was that now?
Is the area in full sun?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. And it's that wonderful heavy clay Appleton soil, is that correct also?
No, it was beautiful soil that I worked up. It was surrounding three apple trees that I have planted, you know, kind of like a border around the apple trees. It's 8-10 inches of really good topsoil.
Okay. There just are not a lot of plants that are going to grow that.
Prairie plants,
at least native plants. Yeah, I'm trying to think of anything that would besides violets.
Species tulips. Instead of growing the big tulips with the pretty flowers, grow the species tulips. They tend to be 6 to 8 inches. And a number of them will actually come back a lot more successfully than the tall, big flowered tulips, and they will quietly spread. So that's something for early spring. It's not a prairie plant, but they're quite attractive, and there's a wide variety of them, so you can have waves of color in there. But other than that, there's some I'm blanking. There's some campanula that are very low growing. There's a lot of rock garden plants that are low growing, but not a whole lot.
Yeah, as far as butterfly attractants, most of those are taller plants.
What about some of the short ornamental alliums, Neil?
I'm not terribly familiar with those, so I work with the native plants, and so there are a number of alliums that maybe get a foot to 2 feet tall, like the nodding pink onion, Allium ternuum, and then Allium stellatum, the prairie onion, but these are all going to exceed that height.
Allium moly.
The plant Nazis are going to come and cut them down.
Yeah,
again.
That's something I would be pursuing, or at least investigating.
Yeah, this sounds like a First Amendment in violation here, freedom of planting. So I don't know. It seems
and
very
if
strange.
If that isn't an amendment, it should be. So good luck with that. I hope we've been able to help a little bit, Steve.
All right, well, I'll keep listening. Maybe other people come in with other ideas, maybe even some woody-type plants that might work that the city would allow to be taller or small bushes or something.
Well, there's a number of low-growing woody ground covers, Stephanandra. comes to mind. It might be taller than 8 inches, so you'd have to check that, but it's used as a low-growing ground cover.
And here we go into this whole topic again of plant racism, where trees and shrubs have different status from flowers and grasses.
Right, you can grow an apple tree, but not... That's interesting.
Absolutely. It's absolute discrimination against non-woody plants. I think you have a lawsuit on your hands.
Okay, we're going to stop this topic before Neil starts ranting here, although I agree. I mean, that would be very frustrating as a gardener. Then we've got Barbara in Milwaukee. Hi, Barbara.
Hi. I was able to grow an absolutely stupendous crop of purslane by applying vinegar to a large brick driveway to keep out the weeds in the spring and in the early summer, and then by fall it was covered with purslane.
Yeah, they'll put up with a lot.
They love it hot, and they're a taproot, so they can go right down through that narrow little crack in the
yep.
sidewalk or driveway.
I also think the acidity of the vinegar might have been helpful.
Yeah, well, I've grown it just about everywhere.
My pH at home is 7.3 to 7.5, yeah. And purslane is happy there. So I think it's pretty, you know, it can grow from like pH 4.5 to 8, I think.
Hey, it's great in salads.
True. But it also kept out most of the other weeds, so it kind
of threw
the purslane to the exclusion of everything else.
Well, you know what? When we do a prairie seeding, the first year, annual weeds tend to dominate. Well, you have a wide variety of annual weeds. It can be anything from, you know, 10-foot high giant ragweed, 6-foot high six-foot high velvet leaves and pigweed. But when I see purslane on a prairie in the first year, that's the best thing because it's covering the soil, retaining moisture, outcompeting other taller weeds, and it has a taproot, which only sucks moisture and nutrients out of that very localized area. It's
there
like a free mulch ground cover. It's the best weed for a first-year prairie.
And free salad as well.
And free salad.
Thanks for that call, Barbara. We've got time for just a few more, and we've got an email. Let me just see if... Okay, talking about killing things. This is a gentleman in Rice Lake wants to know how to kill spotted knapweed in his prairie.
Spotted knapweed. There is another non-native weedy plant. This is a really tough plant. It's a biennial. It grows in dry sandy soils or gravelly soils, and it creeps by runners, and it spreads by seed, and you can use herbicides on it, but when it's in a prairie, it's very risky, because of drift. What most people do is they will go out and hand remove it with a trowel or some kind of a narrow digging unit, which is a real, real pain. And because it has these rhizomes, you don't always get to plant the first time, so it will come back.
So you have to repeat again and again.
And you have to go back. And whatever happens, do not allow it to go to seed, because then it will reinfest the area. So you have to remove it and then be very vigilant. And after you've got it out of there for a few years, then typically, unless it's coming in from adjacent areas, blowing in from other areas where the plant exists, you can usually keep it pretty well under control.
Well, we hope that helps. And patience, again, is a virtue for gardeners.
That's a tough one.
I think we've got time for about one last call. This is Joan in Baraboo. Hi, Joan.
Hi. Just a quick suggestion for the guy that wants something less than 8 inches that grows wonderfully and spreads and is, I think, beautiful, wild ginger.
Wild ginger is great for the woods, but he has
sunny full sun.
Area.
It grows in the sun in my house.
Is that right?
Really?
It grows anywhere here.
Wow. Well, actually, mine has spread into sunny areas, but it does seem to be happier in part sun, part shade.
It's a tough plant.
Yeah.
And I love that plant.
I do too. Those little flowers that are hanging down, hiding underneath the leaves.
They are, I think the leaves are beautiful.
Oh, yeah.
I enjoy them.
It's not a big butterfly plant because it's not a good pollen. Good nectar plant.
And he was looking for things that attract.
He was looking for a butterfly. But you know what? This is great that you bring this up, Joan, because the wild ginger, and I live on a 20-acre buckthorn farm, and I cut down the buckthorn, and then the sun gets to the ground and turns into garlic mustard. Okay, so, wow, isn't that great? I get rid of one to achieve the other. Well,
you can eat garlic mustard, Neil. So we're back to food again.
I've got 1,000 salads waiting for you.
There you go.
Come on over. But what I have done is once I've eliminated the garlic mustard, I plant wild ginger. And it will keep out the garlic mustard.
Oh, good point. It smothers it, covers the soil.
It smothers it, and I swear it's a allopathic because you can make candy ginger out of it.
I think it's
used in chemical warfare, I will bet you, because it keeps almost everything out. And if you look at wild ginger in nature, it forms solid stands almost to the exclusion of other native species.
Good point.
So it's using something, probably chemical warfare, plus the roots completely encompass the surface soil. And if you have problems with buckthorn and garlic mustard in a wooded area, I'll tell you what, your saving plant, your answer plant is the wild ginger. It's amazing.
Well,
and it will grow right on top of, practically on rocks.
I
have rocky soil, and I just make a hole between a rock with a little dirt, and you get the root in there, get it established, it completely covers it. It's fabulous, and it will grow on good soil, too.
Well, I just
That's
love it.
That's a very good idea.
And nobody seems to see it. That and the hepatica. I love the leaves on
I love the woodland
too.
Plants like
and
that.
And hepatica's not real tall either.
No, but again, you're talking shade.
Yeah.
Now,
hepatica will grow in the sun.
That's true.
Yes, as will bloodroot, and they're great bee plants.
So these are all some great ideas, and we're going to have lots of more ideas. Larry Mueller will be back on Monday. We've been talking with Neil DeBole of Prairie Nursery, and you can learn more about his prairie business, his company, at prairienursery.com. That's www.prairienursery.com. And the number there is 1-800-476-9453. Neil, I've greatly enjoyed having you on as usual.
Always a pleasure, Shelley.
And also we want to thank Karen Prager, Joe Hardkey for technical assistance and keeping me from doing anything really silly, and to Keisha Marbra for on-air production. And thanks to everyone for listening. I hope I will be back doing this again. And this is Shelley Ryan in for Larry Mueller on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.